Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour. Motor Talk with Toby Hagen.
Toby, how are you?
I'm good, Phil. How are you?
Yeah, not well. Not bad. Not bad. Latest vehicle sales figures show the market is still struggling. Things are crook out there, aren't they?
Things are very crook, yeah. And this is something I don't think the industry expected. There was obviously the downturn in vehicle sales started about a year and a half ago. The interesting thing is it just doesn't seem like slowing down. So the previous, so the September sales figures were down 6.9%. off the back of a 5.5% drop for the same month last year. So so it's compound. We're seeing compounding now of the drop, and certainly there's people readjusting not only their orders but also dealers and so on trying to work out how they, I guess, figure it out, dealing with a lower level of or lower number of vehicles going through. So, yeah, some pretty tough times. Not everyone was down in the dumps. Mazda was a rear winner, up 15.5%, but most of the market absolutely down. So Toyota down almost 13%, Hyundai 11%, Subaru 26%, Honda 25%, Volkswagen 19%. So some pretty sizable drops there. And as I said, most of those are off the back of drops in the same month from the previous year. Holden was hit very hard, worst ever sales in its history. So yet again, another poor
that's
month.
Out of the top 10 sellers now.
It was in September, yeah, absolutely. So year to date, they're still in the top 10 just. I think they're 9th or 10th. But in terms of the top 10 for September, the September sales figures, yes, they were out of the top 10. First time it's ever happened. I mean, this is a brand that traditionally has been 1, 2, sometimes 3, and over the last couple of years, obviously, it's really dropped down. First time, for the first time ever as well, Mercedes-Benz outside Holden. So it was...
You're kidding.
That shows you just how much the market has turned around. Yeah, I mean, it's... and even Merck's even down as well. So it's... yeah, to have them ahead of them. But yeah, I mean, it's... Look, yeah, the market's changed enormously. And I don't think anyone would have seen that coming even a year or two ago. Certainly not 10 years ago. I mean, it was absolutely unthinkable. But yeah.
Top-selling cars are still the same, are the big utes?
Pretty much, yeah. Utes are still going pretty strongly. Look, it's a segment of the market that we seemingly can't get enough of, and obviously people are scrambling to get in there. That said, brands like Mercedes-Benz, you know, which we've talked about, the X-Class ute, and that is still struggling fairly heavily. Its sales have trickled up a little bit, but it's still nowhere near where it needs to be. So that's a real challenge for them. But yes, generally the large utes are going well. Large SUVs, funnily enough, are also going amazingly well. So Nissan Patrol up 16%, Toyota Land Cruiser up 3.3%. Keeping in mind, Land Cruiser is always a very one of the top selling vehicles. It's seems to be perennially popular. And even some of the luxury large SUVs, BMW X7, Audi Q8, and strong sales from Range Rover as well, all helping boost those large SUV sales. So you're really seeing, you know, we talk about this shift towards more fuel-efficient vehicles and obviously smaller vehicles, yeah. But large SUVs are booming at the moment.
I was going to say, that's right, whatever happened to fuel economy?
But it's interesting, though. I mean, fuel prices obviously now are reasonably affordable. The minute fuel prices go up, you suddenly see though you tend to see in the past we've seen those large SUVs really drop off substantially. So people start saying, "Oh, hang on a minute, do I want to go paying $1.80 or $2 whatever a litre for fuel?" And they start reevaluating. But but at the moment, all a lot of strength in there.
There's money around too, isn't there? I mean, Ferrari had a pretty big month. Ferrari sold 23 cars last month.
Yeah, which
now,
is...
Now, considering the average cost of these things...
Yeah, well, they actually outsold Chrysler last month, so that's... but Chrysler's down in the dumps as well. But yeah, look, at the top end of the market, very few of them are worried. They're all sort of saying, well, look, the people who've got that sort of money...
Yeah.
And let's face it, no one needs a Ferrari, no one needs a Lamborghini, no one needs a McLaren. They are all toys. They're all something to, you know, to grace typically a garage with many, many vehicles in it. So, yeah, I mean, they're saying, look, we're not too worried about it. Where you tend to see downturns in those sorts of vehicles is when it's unfashionable to be driving them. So in the GFC, for example, sometimes people didn't want to be seen driving around in a bright red Ferrari with the roof down. You know, it wasn't the thing to be done. But at the moment, that doesn't seem to be an issue.
Ford's announced their limited edition Australia-only model of the Mustang.
Yeah, there's some really interesting stuff going on. So this is called the Mustang R-Spec.
Mm-hmm.
Not exactly cheap. It's about $100,000, but it does get a supercharger thrown onto the engine. So basically, it starts as a Mustang GT. It goes off to a mob in Melbourne called Herod Performance, a very well-respected engineering company that's done a lot of the engineering work on this. They're also using Ford Performance components out of the US for it. So supercharger on it, they've lowered the suspension a bit, put adjustable dampers in there, thicker stabilizer bars, wider wheels and tires, and obviously you've got the styling tweaks, so a bigger rear wing, you've got stripes, you've got some blacked out bits instead of chrome flashing around, they sort of black out even the Mustang badge on the front. So
mm-hmm.
500 they're making, they'll start hitting the market in a couple of months. And, yeah, it's a it's an interesting, as I said, an interesting sort of arrangement they've got going. Ford will be offering the full five-year factory warranty on these vehicles, even though they are modified aftermarket. But they say they've done all the engineering work, or Herod Performance has done all the engineering work and made sure that it meets Ford standards. So, so yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that one sells.
There you go. Land Rover's working on a remote control technology for its Defender. So you can, drive the car from outside the car.
Outside the car, yeah. This is really interesting. I spoke to one of the engineers over in at the Frankfurt Motor Show a few weeks ago, and he said, yeah, we're starting to look at this sort of technology. They've even developed it. They've basically got all the tech ready to go. All they're waiting for now is regulatory approval. So,
what would you do? Where would you use this?
So the big advantage, or where they see it coming into play, a lot of people who do serious off-roading will actually get out of the car to check whether their car will make it over a log, for example, or whether they're going to hit something or if they're going to get stuck in a bog. So they'll get out, or they'll use a spotter. So they'll get mm-hmm. someone else outside the car to do that spotting for them. So this obviously allows the driver to get out of the car and remotely control the vehicle and get it over some potentially tricky situations. So, look, I tend to think it's perhaps a little bit more gimmick than yep. genuine usefulness for the average punter, but look, it's a pretty good party trick to show your friends. Obviously, get outside and remote control your car. It's not on, that Defender's not on sale till mid next year in Australia, and that technology won't be available, I would have thought, for at least a year or two after that. As I said, they're waiting for regulatory approval, and let's face it, we don't have the most progressive governments with that sort of stuff.
Hey, speaking about Ferraris, you've driven the Ferrari F8 Tributo. Is it Tributo or Tributo?
Tributo is what I've been saying, but I'm...
You reckon it's got a bit of stonk?
Sure does, yeah. So, look, it's very evolutionary compared with the model it replaced, the 488. So, actually shares the same roof, the same glass, the same doors, but got some fresher and certainly more engaging styling front and rear, a bit more power. They've basically stepped it up to 530 kilowatts of power, which is an enormous amount of grunt. But the way that engine works, 3.9-litre twin-turbo V8, the torque or the pull it has from very low in the rev range and extremely quickly after you first hit the throttle is so impressive. We got to drive it around the Fiorano, which is Ferrari's private mm-hmm. test track. So an amazing opportunity, obviously, there to drive, to unleash it in that sort of stuff. But we also drove it around the roads in that part of Italy, around Maranello and Modena and so on. And it was actually quite wet that day. And the thing that amazed me was how easy and how comparatively user-friendly this car was for something that is such a beast when you get to unleash it on a track. So, yeah, it was quite user-friendly, very very clever traction control system on it to make sure that you couldn't get into too much trouble. But at the same time, a load of grunt and heaps of fun.
Mm. You wanted to wag a finger at the royal family.
I did, yeah. I've seen recently a few things that it amazes me how many of them don't seem to wear seatbelts. And obviously, Prince Philip was involved in that crash whenever it was 6 or 12 months ago. And not long after that, he was caught, like within days of it, he was caught not wearing a seatbelt.
Yeah. He handed his license after that, didn't he?
Yeah, and then I went and saw pictures of, you go and search for pictures of the Queen driving and so on, and the ones I searched today, she doesn't seem to wear seatbelts. No. Obviously, in the back, I guess it's different when you're getting driven around at 10 kilometres an hour in a parade, but even when she's driving on regular roads and so on, she doesn't seem to wear seatbelts that often. And this amazes me for, obviously, such a high-profile crash with Princess Diana many years ago when the people in that car weren't wearing seatbelts. Now, I guess it's open to speculation as to whether they would have survived if they were. It was a huge crash. But it astounds me they wouldn't take that such a simple step. And for a family that is in the public eye so often, it amazes me they don't at least do it for the image that it sends to the rest of the
public.
Do you
reckon it's a generational thing? I mean, they would have grown up in a generation where you didn't wear seatbelts. And then they would have, you know, been drivers when seatbelts came in.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
You may not remember this because, you know, you're younger than us, but I mean, there was a huge hullabaloo about it at the time. Yeah. And, you know, people said, oh, you know, why should I have to? And, you know, it's not safe anyway. And there was quite some pushback about being made to wear seatbelts.
Yeah. Well, and yeah.
Maybe it's a generational thing.
Look, I think it is. And look, there are times in Australia today where you don't legally have to wear a seatbelt in a car that's old enough. And certainly, as you say, look, a lot of the royal family would have driven some of those cars. But you look at the crash statistics and it's fairly plain. I mean, it's roughly 20% of occupant fatalities in Australia involve people not wearing seatbelts. And we have nothing like that number of people not wearing seatbelts. I mean, we've got high 90%
We've got high compliance rates in Australia, haven't we? Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. So if you look at that and say, well, okay, 1 in 5 occupant fatalities are people who are unbelted, then clearly it's a major issue. And it suggests that the injury rate is something like 10 times greater if you have a crash without wearing a seatbelt. So as I said, I do find it incredible they wouldn't take that relatively simple step to at least have the public image there that they're
it's a fair point.
Doing the right thing.
It's a fair point. Just before we do that, you've been driving the Model 3 Tesla.
I have, yes.
So, and what's your impression?
Look, the impression is I've been driving. So actually, I drove what they call a standard range one a month or so ago, and that's a reasonably impressive car. I've driven the performance version, which is the top of the range. I've just been driving that this week,
right?
And performance is absolutely an apt description of it. It's got incredible step off performance. So the second you hit the throttle, it just launches.
It gives
and goes.
You a neck injury, doesn't it?
It doesn't quite give you a neck injury, but it but it does surge you back into your seat, and if you just got someone in the car who's not expecting it, the look on their face is impressive, and you can go to YouTube and look at a whole bunch of videos of people doing that in Teslas. But yeah, certainly that acceleration, that thrust is really impressive. Look, it's a terrific car for just zipping around town in terms of you've got plenty of range. It seems to be ready to get about sort of 350 odd k's comfortably on a charge.
Which is tons for a day's driving.
Yeah, that's right. Look, the ride on this one with the performance model, the suspension's lowered slightly. It's got lower profile tyres, so it's not as comfortable as some might expect in a luxury vehicle. And this is a $100,000 car, by the way. So it's not bargain price, but the ride's not terrific, but it's fairly well sorted. You can feel that super low center of gravity. To me, it's not the most stylish vehicle around, particularly in that market, but you start to appreciate it more when you drive it more. I've still got issues with some of the fit and finish and some of the quality details here and there. I think they do need to work on that sort of thing, and certainly that car I had this week it suffers from a bit of that, but you can understand the showroom appeal of this car is incredible. My little guy, my son, his favourite feature is turning the indicators into a whoopee cushion. So you can
turning the indicators into a... Oh!
So when you hit the indicators, you get funny sounds.
You get a farting noise.
He was laughing out loud for 10 minutes. So.
Kids would love that, wouldn't they?
He thought it was the best thing ever. So yeah, it's got some things like that my wife didn't find it quite as funny, by the way. But some things like that which are gimmicky but quirky, I guess. So.
Yeah, one of my texts, we'll go to course next, but one of my texters says just back on the seatbelts things... My mother, Phil, what do you mean was? My mother still insists that allegedly some people were better off without seatbelts because they were, quote, thrown clear. What the state of their spinal column and personal mobility might have been after being thrown clear remains to be seen. Look, exactly. That's what people used to say, things like that. You'll be thrown clear of the crash, so therefore you'll be all right. Yeah. I.e. thrown clear at 80 k's an hour. And
that's right. There might be 1 in 10,000 crashes where you may have been slightly better off, but I'll tell you what, for the vast majority, you're going to be better off with it. And look, in old convertibles, you could maybe argue that, where they didn't have rollover protection. These days, modern convertibles all have some form of rollover protection, even if it's just a strengthened pillar around the windscreen.
And
you'd rather be strapped in than not.
Fair enough. Let's get some calls. Plenty of people on the line. Tony, hello.
Hello, Philip. Hello, Toby. Thanks very much for taking the call. I wanted a bit of an update, if I could, please. I spoke to you, Toby, a couple of years ago. I ended up getting an SV6 Holden a couple of months before they stopped making them. And I asked you the question, what would I replace it with? And you said maybe one of the Audis. And then I heard you last year saying one of the great things about Australian cars of this sort of size and performance is they handle well, but it's the mid-range torque and response. I drove my daughter's Astra 150 kilowatts, and it only worked nicely when it was screaming.
Mm.
So what would you replace an SV6 Commodore with in a year's time when I need to buy my own car, can I ask, please?
Yeah, that's a challenging one. So you still need the space, do you? You need the rear seat space? And
No, not particularly. No, I mean, as long as it's a four-seater. But the size of the car, it sits nicely. It's got the golden ratio of width to length between the wheels, so it handles really nicely. So I drove a Cruise. It wasn't too narrow. It didn't handle right. So it doesn't have to be this big, but it needs to sort of have that handling and torque and mid-range response that these sort of cars have.
Look, funnily enough, you're actually going to find that mid-range response in some of the newer, even four-cylinder vehicles with a turbocharger will in many ways be better. So, and what you're noticing, so that the 150-kilowatt Astra is more a performance-focused four-cylinder, so they've tuned it more for top-end performance. But particularly a lot of the petrol engines coming out of Europe these days, they tune them for that mid-range performance. So you end up with a little bit more of it's a bit more asthmatic at the top end, but it's at the mid-range, it's really nice and flexible. And look, a good example of that would be the current Commodore. The current Commodore engine is the 2-litre turbo is a very good flexible mid-range engine. But there's a whole heap more as well. I mean, look, if you want even more grunt and a whole bunch more performance compared with what your SV6 has got, something like a Kia Stinger obviously is a terrific step up. You'll probably end up using a bit more fuel because you've got that extra performance there. But you can even go a bit left field. Things like, a Skoda Superb, for example, is I wouldn't say superb, but it's a very good car.
Yeah.
If you just want basic, easy, around-town driving, and this might be a shock for someone who's been in Commodores and likes, I guess, their driving enjoyment, but the current Toyota Camry is also a really good buy. And the Toyota Camry Hybrid has decent mid-range performance and is surprisingly enjoyable to drive compared with some Camrys of the past. So there's a bunch of, I guess, your mainstream ones. You can step into something like a Mazda 6 as well. And the Mazda 6 Turbo actually is a very nice, good, flexible engine as well. So that'd be worth a look.
What about the new Holden, the V6 one, the 3.6 litre
Commodore?
Commodore.
Well, I'd actually say the turbo is better for mid-range performance. The advantage with the V6 is it's all-wheel drive, whereas the 2-litre turbo is only front-wheel drive. So it depends whether you want that, I guess, that extra traction if you're going to be driving on gravel roads or to the snow or something like that. But the mid-range performance of the 2-litre turbo Commodore is better than the 3.6 for sure.
Okay. All right, Tony. Well, we'll move on. Others want to have a say, mate. Thanks. Good on you, mate. Thank you. And thanks for the call. Jeff is on the line. G'day, Jeff.
G'day. How you going?
Not bad.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm semi-retired. I've got a VY that's done 320,000 k's and will probably run till it's about 600,000 k's. It's really good. But I want to spend about 20,000, but my wife doesn't like i30s or the small cars, so would you have a suggestion of some sort?
Well, I'm going to come back.
15,000 k's a year tops.
Yeah, okay. I'm going to come back to a Toyota Camry, and you might just get into one for that, although it might be a bit of a struggle given your 15,000K requirement or one-year requirement.
Oh, sorry, no, I'd only do 15,000K.
Oh, sorry. So okay, the car can be more than a year old.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, cool. Okay, well, look, stick to petrol rather than diesel for that, which makes more sense. And we should point out to anyone listening, the VY you're talking about is a VY Commodore.
And 2003.
Yeah, you got good life out of it anyway.
It's a fantastic car.
Yeah. So, look, a lot of what I just spoke about just then would apply here absolutely in terms of a Camry, and I think, you wouldn't necessarily need the hybrid one for what you're doing, but the hybrid is a fairly impressive gadget. If you're doing mainly around town or some country cars as well?
We just, We do 100, 150 k's a week around town, maybe 100. And we go to Bright from, and I'm in Melbourne, so I go to Bright 6 or 7 times a year, which is 600 k's return.
Yeah, yeah,
so,
cool.
15,000 k's, 20,000 if we really pushed it.
Yeah, cool. Well, yeah, something like, yeah, as I said, a Camry's pretty hard to beat in terms of the value for money. Volkswagen Passat would also be worth looking at.
Oh, okay, yep.
Or or that Mazda 6, and again, a Mazda 6 Turbo. The only thing is, getting into one, you'd have to go probably about 3 years old for something like that to get to that 20,000 yep. limit. But, yep. But yeah, look, there's plenty of good buying yeah. in those.
How old's the Passat?
Well, you can get a brand new one now, but if you want to get a second hand, I mean, you... as new as you can get for 20 grand. But one of the things with Volksy, they give you a fair few choices in terms of engines. So you can, you know, the starting price is around 40 grand for one of those, and they go up to over $60,000. So obviously you'd try and look at one of the base models. They call it the 132 TSI. And I would imagine you'd probably have to go 3 or 4 years old to get that sort of thing.
Good luck with it, Jeff. Let's try another Jeff. G'day.
Yeah, thanks, Phil and Toby. Thanks for taking the call. I'm looking at a Isuzu MUX, and what's an equivalent to an MUX, and also the diesel. What's the diesel like in the MUX?
So MUX sells well above, or punches well above its weight in terms of sales. They Isuzu doesn't have a whole lot of models to deal with. We take trucks out of the equation and just focus on their, I guess, their family-focused vehicles. You've got the MUX and you've got the D-Max Ute, and that's it. So they tend to pump a lot of marketing energy into it, and as a result, they sell amazingly well. Particularly with the D-Max, it sort of surprises me a bit because it is feeling fairly tired and fairly a little bit old now, particularly in a Ute segment that has advanced so much over the last 2 or 3 years in particular. So I'm not a huge rat for that. The MUX is obviously largely based on the D-Max. It uses the same underpinnings. It uses the same engine. The 3-litre engine is getting a bit tired. It's a bit gruff in terms of its refinement, so it's not the most refined thing out there. So it probably wouldn't be my number one choice in that segment. It's got a reputation for reliability, but look, other cars in that market also have it. And you can look at things like a Ford Everest, for example, which you're going to pay more for. But a Holden Trailblazer is probably a good midway that will also give you a very strong engine. It'll give you a reasonable value. They're doing deals at the moment with 7-year warranty on it. So from that perspective, it's also worth a look. You can also look at Mitsubishi Pajero Sport. The one thing with the Pajero Sport is it's noticeably narrower in the cabin than the other one. So it's a slightly smaller vehicle, but it's also reasonable buying for what it is. But if value, toughness, reliability, all that sort of thing is important to you, and you can't stretch to, say, a Toyota Prado or a Ford Everest, then I reckon the Holden Trailblazer is probably a reasonable midway bet.
Okay.
Right.
Hello, Jeff. Thank you, mate. Battery warranties. Grant, hello.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Welcome.
A few years ago, I purchased a battery from a retailer, and for some unknown reason, I had only an 18-month warranty on it. And after about 13 or 14 months, the battery died. Mm-hmm. I took it back to the retailer, and he said, "Yep, it's buggered. We will replace it, but be aware that your warranty's transferred from the old battery to the new, which only left me with a 3-month warranty." And then, about a month after that, that battery failed, and I took it back to the retailer, and he said, "Yep, you're out of warranty. Tough luck."
You've been leaving your lights on, right?
Now, the question I have is that obviously the battery was defective when it was installed, but why do these people transfer the warranty onto a new battery? Why can't they give you a full warranty on the new battery?
Yeah, that does sound strange to me, and I would have thought with a replacement battery that comes in and, you know, okay, let's say for argument's sake it was a very long warranty, a 3 or 4 year warranty for a battery, and it died after a few months, I would have thought you'd absolutely be okay in getting that sorted out. I would, in an instance like that, I would actually go to check out your rights with either the ACCC.
I would too. That doesn't sound right to me, Grant.
It doesn't at all.
It's happened to me twice.
Yeah. I'd be checking that out, wouldn't you, Toby, with Consumer Affairs?
Consumer Affairs in your state or the ACCC, absolutely. Because
I actually went back and the retailer said, take it back to the agents, because I'm in country WA.
Yeah.
Take it back to the agents in Perth. And I took the battery back to them, and the guy was rather off-handed. And he said, yeah, that's the way it goes. He said, we'll test the battery. He rang me back and said, come and get your battery. We don't want it on the premises. It's buggered. That's what it's going to be. So that was 27 years ago. So I wonder if he still got it.
Oh, hang on. That was 27 years. Gee, Grant.
Yeah, you might struggle to get the thing replaced at this stage.
I would, I think I'd check with Consumer Affairs. That doesn't sound right.
And these days, the ACCC is very much onto that sort of thing.
Yep,
and
yep.
I would have thought. And look, the other thing is obviously the retailer can't fob you off. Either the retailer has to deal with you.
No, absolutely.
Deal with your complaint.
Very much so. Mark.
Yes. You know the Tanaka airbag.
Yeah. Takata, yep.
Yeah, oh, Takata.
Takata, yep.
Okay, well, anyway, I hit a tree one night,
yep.
And the airbags went off and bang, you know. So anyway, I kept getting mail, and so I filled the form out that said that the car is deceased and it's gone off to Sims Metal and it's been turned into Chinese steel.
Mm-hmm.
And I keep getting, the mail from Nissan.
Yeah, right.
Oh, saying you need to replace your airbag?
No. Yeah, that's right. No, they want to come in for an inspection. Even
that's what I mean. Yeah, yeah.
I filled the form in. So who's running that show?
It's actually been bounced around a fair bit in terms of... So the car company started off doing it. The ACCC decided they weren't doing a good enough job, so they instigated the first ever involuntary recall in Australia. So it was a compulsory recall. Overseen by the ACCC, they've given them till the end of next year, the end of 2020, to make sure that they're all replaced. And they're looking for 100% compliance, which is almost impossible because of issues like yours, because of paddock bashes that might end up on a farm just dead somewhere. Getting to that 100%, and we're talking 3 million cars here, so it's not a small number. And so, yeah, the ACCC's got pretty heavily involved with it. There are also... At the moment, you've also got state governments getting involved and threatening not to register cars as well that have not had those airbags replaced. And we're talking, there's two different types here. We've got the alpha ones and the beta ones. The alpha airbags, as they're known, are the very dangerous ones. And I think it's half a million roughly were along those lines. But the beta airbags aren't at this stage, with most states and territories aren't subjected to that. But the Federal Chamber of Automotive Industries is calling on that. So you've got the ACCC, the car makers, the Federal Chamber of Automotive Industries, and the various dealers all chasing it. But I would go to the website ismyairbagsafe.com.au and try to plug it into that as well. And if not, try ringing Nissan and I'll do some digging around as well and see what I can find out.
Righto. Okay. Debbie, hello.
Oh, hello. How are you going?
I'm pretty well, thanks.
Oh, good. My question is, my daughter, her car's just died. She had a really old Daewoo that ran on the smell of an oily rag.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to buy her a new car. We've got a budget of $10,000. Which is financed for her, but so it has to be no more than 7 years old. But mm-hmm. the fuel economy is really important because she's at uni and she has to manage that. We're sort of looking at Priuses or Ford Focuses, but I don't know. I would love some advice.
Yeah, cool. You've come to the right man.
Yeah, cool.
Thank you.
The first thing I'd say is don't be tempted into... So you mentioned Ford Focus. The Ford Focus is no more efficient than a whole bunch of other small cars, Mazda 3, Toyota Corolla, Volkswagen Golfs and so on. So, and the one thing is there may be a temptation on the fuel economy side to launch yourself into a diesel engine, which will typically use 25 to 30% less fuel. I would absolutely not go down the diesel route for what she's looking for because...
Yep.
While she may save a little bit on daily fuel runnings, she's going to pay more in servicing. There are other issues associated with diesels for around town running and trying to save fuel like that. So I wouldn't be going for that. In terms of I guess the biggest way you're going to save fuel is by downsizing the car. The less weight you've got to carry around, the less fuel the car will have to use. So the smaller you look, the better chance you have of getting a more fuel-efficient car. Something like a Honda Jazz, Suzuki Swift, Mazda 2 would be three terrific little cars in that end of the market. Or you could look at, you mentioned Prius, and look, yes. Priuses are, to some extent, fairly unloved on the used car market.
Oh, I love the Prius. I had one that was my favourite car.
Yeah, so, and look, don't just limit yourself to a normal Prius. You can also look at the Prius C, which it was a smaller one. They didn't sell as many as the normal Prius. But one of the reasons Priuses are a bit unloved on the used market is particularly those earlier ones, it was businesses often that bought them, businesses and governments. So in the used car market, there weren't as many private buyers looking to buy them. So the values got, the prices got dropped on the used car market to try and offload them, to sell them. So you can actually pick up a fairly decent, relatively new Prius. And for $10,000, I think you'd have a few options. But as I said, I'd be looking at that Prius C as well, because that's also, look, basic motoring, but it will be, it'll tick that fuel economy box nicely, and it should be fairly reliable.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. That's great.
Good luck. Keep it secret from me. Make us a surpriser. Thanks, thanks, Debbie. Dave's off around Australia. Can any seats in the car, Dave? I'd like to come too.
Yes. I'm just wondering what would be your choice of a four-wheel drive to take a mid-sized to small caravan around Australia, to beaches, to all that sort of stuff, without going to the nth degree.
And have you looked at, what's the rough budget?
Mate, I was looking around 60.
All right.
I was looking at the Fords.
Generous.
And
so Everest and stuff. Are you looking at, are you open to utes, or would you prefer an SUV?
No, I think a ute would be better if you could put a canopy on the back.
Yeah, sweet. Well, look, of those utes, one thing to keep in mind, once you're starting to do that sort of that more serious off-roading and potentially carrying a fair bit of weight, you know, when you end up going to those more remote areas, you're having to carry water, you've got your camping gear, well, I suppose you've got a caravan, you've got, you know, a whole bunch of stuff like that. So what might work well as a ute that's unladen without much weight in it doesn't necessarily translate to a fully laden one. And things like the Mercedes-Benz X-Class, the Nissan Navara, they're two that maybe struggle a tiny bit on that front, or have in the past. Some of the ones that do a better job of that sort of thing would be the Ford Ranger, the Toyota Hilux. But look, of all the ones you're looking at, of all those utes to do that sort of job, the Ranger does sort of, it ticks a lot of boxes. It does a really good job.
It's, doesn't it? I can't believe they're getting down to the 2 litre motor, aren't they?
Yeah, so you can. So they still do the 3.2 litre 5-cylinder, single turbo, and that's the more affordable engine. The more powerful and torquier engine is the 2 litre twin turbo, which is hooked up to a 10-speed automatic. The 3.2 only gets a 6-speed automatic. So it's got better performance, it's got better fuel economy, and the biggest thing is it's a lot quieter. So it's got better refinement generally.
Even
so
a bit better than the VW.
No, not the V6. No, in terms of the...
No.
So if outright performance is important, no, the VW V6 is... well, that and the Merc V6. But those two have performance nailed. They've got it worked out.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, they're bigger engines. They're much bigger engines generally. And, they've got more grunt. But that 2 litre is a nice engine. And it's, the transmission works really nicely with it. So Ranger would be probably my pick for something like that.
Thank you.
Where are you? Which way are you headed, Dave? Clockwise or counterclockwise?
Counterclockwise, I think. I'm going to the cold.
On you, Dave.
Thank you.
Have a great trip. Plenty of people listening, I'm sure, would be jealous of that. Start their minds would be wandering. Right, I will take some text line calls next up. We've got Stuart on the line. Hi, Stuart.
Oh, good evening, gents. How are you?
Not bad.
Good.
That's good. I'm just looking at just a small second car, so like a Corolla or a Mazda 3 or something like that. I suppose I'm a bit of a traditionalist and still thinking the old manual thing, but I'm just wanting to know, is that limiting my choices or limiting my thinking by still doing the manuals?
Yeah, look, it's certainly limiting your choices. Things like a Subaru Impreza, for example, are not available with a manual transmission. So you're going to rule out a few of the models in there. But they're still there if you want them. And admittedly, they're a tiny percentage of sales. They typically hover around 2, 3, 4% of sales of those small hatchbacks. What I would actually recommend with something like that is don't give away to the dealer. When you walk in there, don't give away that you absolutely want a manual. But be open to a manual when there's one there. And what you might find is you might end up with a decent discount on it because they'll find those sorts of ones harder to shift. So if they've got one sitting there in dealer stock, they might be more open to crunching a deal on it. If you go in and say, oh, mate, I've got to have a manual, they've seen you coming, they're going to charge you full whack for it. But as I said, just play a little bit dumb and that you'd be open to a manual if it was the right price and see what they say. But in terms of picking a manual between those ones, look, Mazda 3, the latest Mazda 3 and Corolla are probably the two top in that class at the moment. So they are well worth a look. You can forget Honda Civic, it's not available with a manual. But Mazda 3 or Toyota Corolla. If I was going to choose, I'd put Mazda 3 1, Corolla 2.
Is there
I-30 got a manual? Yeah, I-30's got a manual. It's the car generally is not as polished as those other two. You get that in the price too, so it's a more affordable car. Part of the reason it's more affordable is Hyundai doesn't put the all the latest active safety gear as standard on the base model car, so you've actually got to pay extra for that or step up to a more expensive model. So if that stuff's important to you, then I'd, as I said, the Mazda and the Toyota will both get that standard, whereas Hyundai will charge extra for it. Hyundai's good value would be a nice way to put it, and they're doing some 7-year warranty deals at the moment. Kia's also worth a look as well. Kia Cerato is worth a look too with that sort of thing as well. So, okay. Yeah.
Good luck with it.
Thank you, gents.
Good luck with it. Just back to some texts, Toby. Oliver says, Toby, your thoughts on a 2002 to 2006 Jaguar X-Type as a first car for a P-plater? Any other recommendations? They seem very affordable at between $6,000 and $10,000.
Yeah, there's a reason.
There's always a reason.
Look, the X-Type was pretty underwhelming. Jaguar knew it at the time. So underneath, it's actually based on a Ford Mondeo.
So it's a Ford Mondeo underneath.
It's effectively a Ford Mondeo with some fancy gear on top and some old man styling. So it sold accordingly. It was not the most convincing Jaguar they've done. And they, as I said, they quietly realised that. They then came out it was only 4 or 5 years ago, the XE was effectively the replacement for that and a far more convincing vehicle. Keep that in mind that it's, this was back in the days as well when Jaguar's reliability probably wasn't where it needs to be, and it's still, there's still issues there with Jaguar Land Rover in terms of that sort of stuff, but certainly that era of car I would be very, very wary of, especially as a first car for a P-plater where you might be hoping for a bit of reliability and a bit of set and forgetness. Fair. Go in eyes wide open.
Peter from Narrogin in Western Australia says this, I've got a 2017 diesel manual Captiva. It's done 234,500 Ks. Still appears to be going strong. It's been serviced regularly. Spent most of its time on country roads. What sort of lifespan does this make of vehicle usually have? Is it better to keep a vehicle this age going or quit while the going is good? I know it's an interesting question, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Look, I think you could absolutely expect, if it's been looked after, if you're treating it properly and servicing it, I think you get many more kilometres than that out of it.
Would you get 400 out of it?
I would have thought so, yeah. If it's looked after and hasn't got any gremlins in there. But, yeah, absolutely, an engine like that, it's, diesel engines typically
have
a reputation for lasting longer and you hear of them doing many, many more Ks than that. And, look, what really hurts an engine is, and this is why taxis tend to go on, you can get taxis hitting 1 million kilometres because they pretty much run
all the time.
Not quite 24/7, but they're not far off it. A properly run taxi is a work vehicle. It's just sent out there to drive the whole time. So it's not doing cold starts. And cold starts are one of the things that are really bad on an engine, partly because the engine has to expand and the metal has to expand and everything has to get back into shape up to temperature, but mainly because all the oil is sitting down the bottom of the engine. So for that first crank, it actually has to splash the oil around all the seals and so on and wake things up. So if you're doing big kilometres and a lot of country kilometres, which are the really gentle thing on cars, sitting on 80 or 100 kilometres an hour, cars love it. They don't have to change gears much. The engine sits at a typically relatively low revs and off it goes. So yeah, I would have thought you could get many, many more Ks. Mm. I mean, you know, that said, if you're going to thrash it around town at high revs and low speed, you probably won't get another couple hundred thousand.
But if it's going well, you've always had it, and you know, like, there's an argument to run it into the ground, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And you should start to get some warning signs that things are going bad.
Sue in Darwin. Hi, Sue. Says, Toby, have you heard, seen anything on the new Kia Seltos yet? Waiting to compare it to the new Hyundai Venue.
So I got a Venue today. I'm driving a Seltos tomorrow.
There you go.
So yeah, Seltos went on sale this week, I believe it was. And yeah, look, they're underneath effectively the same car. Some key differences there. Hyundai with the Venue. So these are both small SUVs, by the way, circa $25,000 plus SUVs. The Kia is available in two-wheel drive and all-wheel drive.
Mm-hmm.
The Hyundai is only available in front-wheel drive, two-wheel drive form. So there are some differences there with spec and so on, but I can't answer your question as to what the Seltos is like, and I've only very briefly driven the Venue. So maybe we can talk about them in a few weeks.
Brian in the Pilbara says, Phil and Toby, when I spend my 100 grand, it won't be on a Tesla. I'll take the Mustang. Yeah. On you, Brian.
That's a good point. And I think there's a lot of people thinking like that now with, you know, we're clearly in probably the heyday of the internal combustion engine, and there's a lot of people saying, well, you know, yes, there are going to be V8s for a few years to come, but probably not in 40 or 50 years. There won't be lots of them, so let's go and have my fun now.
Yep. Christina in Rockdale says, Phil, my mum was thrown from her car in 1954, an Austin hit front on, driver's side by a truck, running a stop sign. She left her laced shoes on the pedals, went out the rear passenger side window.
Yeah.
Lost some teeth, unconscious for 3 weeks, had migraines the rest of her life. As soon as seat belts were available, she wore one. Fair question too. Steve in Aluma says, looking to scratch my midlife crisis, can you tell me what was the last year Australian-made V8s were produced? Any thoughts on these XR8s and all GTs?
So with the Ford, it'll be 2016, and with the Holden, 2017.
So
actually Ford, I'm trying to think if they did it right up to the end. I'm pretty sure they would have been 2016 models. And Holden, yeah, was their last car was produced in November 2017 from memory.
Mm-hmm.
And they built V8s right up to the end pretty much. So plenty of them around.
Stewie says, by the way, Toby, on seatbelts, Mercedes inspected the car that Di was thrown from, concluded that if they had worn seatbelts, they might have survived.
Mm.
Yeah, well, there's always going to be argument there. I mean, but wear your seatbelt, absolutely. Sorry, David, you've been waiting on a bit there. Sorry about that.
That's okay. Thanks for taking the call, Tony. I'm looking at getting rid of a 2011 Prado because it hasn't got the capacity to tow 3 tonne.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking at another second-hand SUV, not a ute, something around 40,000.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking at a Discovery 4. Any idea on reliability? I mean, someone said that, you know, if you have a Toyota in the middle of nowhere, people know what it is. If you have something like a Discovery, they'll never have seen one before. But
yeah, so two issues there. One is the possibility of something going wrong. So let's touch on that one first, which is that Toyota obviously builds its reputation on reliability, and it's not just there for fun. That does actually, you know, all my experience and certainly anecdotally speaking to people, that is a well-earned reputation. Land Rover, on the other hand, is not known for that, and I've certainly experienced issues with Land Rovers in remote areas, sometimes basic stuff, things like shock absorbers giving up, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I've also had plenty of stories relayed to me of other things going wrong. So the air suspension systems in them
can
be a bit fragile and a bit unreliable. the electronic handbrakes can sometimes not do what they're supposed to, either lock on or not work. So there's a bunch of things that can go wrong with that sort of thing, and I would be very cautious. If you're going to go and do a lot of adventuring and put it under the pump, then, yeah, I'd be a bit cautious on it. That
Any
said,
other alternatives? Or?
Well, Prado, I guess. You can go to that sort of thing. Or you can
the 2018 Prado, that'll take 3 ton, is about still around 60 grand.
Yeah, that's right. And it's a very basic car. Like, you don't get... They know they can charge for it, and they do, and it's pretty basic motoring when you get in there.
Mm-hmm. What about the Pathfinder? That currently tows 1,700 or 2,700.
Yeah, well, that leaves a gap, obviously. But are you going off-road?
Oh, not a lot, no.
No, okay. Well, if you're not going off-road, that sort of opens a whole bunch of other possibilities, except the 3-ton limits you to a lot of those heavy-duty off-roaders. So Pathfinder... It's not a direct competitor to those sorts of cars. It's car based underneath,
mm-hmm.
so it's not going to do much off roading, and I wouldn't be hopeful of it towing 3 tons regularly. I don't think it'd do a good job. I think you'd be better off in something like a Nissan Patrol, which is a massive step up, and it's only a 5.6 liter V8 petrol engine, so it's going to use a fair bit of fuel. But it'll do it. Absolutely on its ear, or something like a Land Cruiser, but then you're paying 80 or 90 grand to get into that. I mean, again, they're all limited to 3 tons. So once you talk Ford Everest, MUX, you're limited to 3 tons. I'd probably go the Ford Everest over the MUX.
Yeah, 3 ton would be okay.
So a Ford Everest would be worth a look. The two liter engine in that is a nice thing. But again, you're going to be up around that 60 grand mark by the time you look at one of those as well. And you know, I touched on it earlier, the Holden Trailblazer, it's got a good grunty 2.8 litre engine. It's rated to 3 tonnes, so, you know, it'll probably do a decent job as well.
Mm, okay.
Yeah. Okay.
On you, Dave. Thanks, man. Bye-bye. Next, off to university. Yes, Nicholas?
Hey, how are you?
Not bad.
Good.
Yeah, so I've got a budget around about 7K. And I was just looking at small economical cars. I heard before.
Yep.
You were talking about was it the Ford Focus and Mazda 3 and stuff like that?
Yeah. Do you need? So could you go even smaller than that? Do you need?
I was thinking Getzes and stuff like that.
Yeah. Okay. Now we're talking about
what your opinion. I was thinking what your opinions are on them.
Yeah. Cool. So Hyundai Getz. Look, the advantage with the Getz is there's so many of them on the market. They don't sell them new anymore, but there's so many used ones on the market. They're pretty basic. Their refinement and so on's not great. I'd actually steer you a little bit more to something like a Kia Rio, which actually shared a lot of the componentry. Hyundai and Kia are the same company, so they share a lot of the same components. The advantage with a Rio over a Getz, a lot of it's in warranty. So if you can get one that's less than about 4 or 5 years old, you'll actually have a 7-year warranty on it. So it'll still come with a factory warranty attached to it. So you've got a bit more peace of mind if something goes wrong. They weren't quite as well loved on that used car market. So again, you can pick one up reasonably well. Kia Picanto as well, but it's a pretty small engine and a little bit underwhelming. But Kia Rio would be good buying. Otherwise, you're sort of into that. You know, you're looking at Hyundai Getzes. Hyundai Accent as well is also one worth looking at, albeit not as many on the used car market. So
and they're on manual as well.
They do both. Yeah, manual and auto. So
okay.
So yeah, you're looking at a manual or an auto.
I was actually looking at manuals. I quite enjoy manuals.
Well, that's going to help you even more because they're even less loved on the used car market and you'll pick one up cheaper. And you'll find you'll be able to bargain with people, as I touched on earlier, on the new cars. In the used car market, you'll potentially be able to bargain with that too. And I go in there saying, oh, mate, I was actually hoping to get an auto, but I'll take the manual if you give me a discount. So if you can crunch
it
down.
What are you studying at uni, Nick?
Bachelor of Science.
Good on you.
And then majoring in health sciences.
Good on you. Good luck with it all.
No, thank you very much.
Thanks, mate. A few thoughts for him heading off to uni. And you remember your first car, don't you, Toby? Like,
yeah, absolutely.
My first car was actually a Toyota Crown, of all things.
Yeah, wow. Well, rear-wheel drive. There you go.
I know. Big old lumbering kind of sort of, you know, floating lounge room thing. Old as the hills it was, but... you don't care.
Soldered on.
You don't care. You just think it's great. Have your own wheels.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. Good fun.
Fantastic thing. All right. Look at the time. Heavens above. Time has flown. What else were we going to... Oh, what have you been driving, actually, by the way? You've been We talked about the Tesla Model 3. The Kia Stinger has got a minor update too. You've been driving that?
Yeah, minor update. They've thrown a bright new colour at it, this sort of Jaffa orange. And the one I drove actually had a performance exhaust system. So it sounded reasonably good, but then you start thinking, well, hang on a minute, this is effectively replacing V8s, and it doesn't sound anywhere near as good as a V8. That said, 3.3-litre twin-turbo V6 engine is an absolute cracker. It's got so much grunt from down low, and it really does rev out nicely. So great fun car for what it is, and value for money-wise, terrific. So, yeah, someone who wants a bit more performance, a bit more pizzazz to their driving, it's a great car.
Bronson on the Gold Coast says, my mum's got a Rio. I drive it time to time. Feels nice. My first car was an 88 Skyline.
Hey. Yeah, I really wanted one of those 88 Skylines, the rear-wheel drive ones. I looked at them for ages. Because that was the engine that the Holden Commodore of the day got, very controversially. The VL Commodore got that inline six-cylinder, three-litre engine. And I really wanted one of those Nissan Skylines, but I could never afford it. I gave up.
I wonder how many people's first car was a Datsun 180B.
Yeah, probably quite a few, or a 120Y.
A 120Y. Now we're talking.
Indeed.
Now we're talking. Toby, always fantastic to talk. We got through as many as we could, but there's always been plenty on the board too. Terrific to talk with you, mate. Thanks.
Thank you.
Good driving.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.